Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics Bruegel's podcast. My name is Gunther Molfen. I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm joined today by Mark Lennart, who is the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, based a bit everywhere in Europe, with decentralized structure. And he just wrote a book, in fact, called The Age of Unpeace: How Connectivity Causes Conflict. Mark, when I hear that title, it sounds very much contrary to everything that I was taught when I was a young student. We were always taught connectivity helps to bring people together and is actually going to be good for peace. Now you seem to say the opposite. So what's your book all about?
Well, I had very much the same upbringing. I'm a passionate believer in the European project. And that is based on this simple and powerful idea that binding nations and peoples together creates peace, makes war much more expensive and more difficult to think about. And the big success story of my life has been the European model, where you saw enemies being turned into friends by creating a deep sense of interdependence, firstly with a coal and steel community, and then a common market, and then that gradually being deepened to become a single market and a single currency and all sorts of other aspects of legal, political, economic interdependence. The hope, I think, after the end of the Cold War is that we could spread that model to the world, open borders, promote trade, travel, and the internet could provide almost a sort of new demos for a global political community that was built on the economic structure which globalization would create. But then in 2016, with Brexit and with Trump, what we discovered is that many citizens were deeply unhappy with the world that we were creating. And though there were lots of winners and lots of people, entire countries and continents that became a lot richer, many people thought that they were losers and were rebelling against it. And then more worryingly, what we discovered is that the reason for a lot of the things that were happening were not because globalization wasn't working or was failing, but because in some ways it was almost working too well. So this book sort of started in a dark place for me in 2016 when I was trying to make sense of what was happening in the world. And I spent a long time re-examining a lot of my prior beliefs. And I came to the conclusion, which is slightly shocking, I think, to many Europeans, which is that the connections that knit the world together are also driving it apart. And I discovered through my work that connectivity, in fact, gives people a motive to conflict with each other rather than to cooperate, a whole series of opportunities which they didn't have before we have this deeply interconnected and interdependent world. And I think most scarily, has created a whole new arsenal of weapons which great powers are using against each other to advance their own power, but also to inflict harm on others. And that is quite a big change in the way that I've been looking at the world. And therefore, I think has all important implications as well for how we think about world order and about the best ways of promoting peace in the 21st century.
So let's zoom a little bit into what connectivity and what's your understanding of connectivity and how exactly you see it drives people apart and perhaps creates unpeace. I mean, there's multiple ways in which, of course, different parts of the world, citizens, different parts of societies are also connected. I mean, there is the most obvious traditional ways, trade in goods, trade in services increasingly. But then, of course, also finance. And I would say most importantly nowadays, perhaps information flows. Where's your thinking on these kind of connectivities and how they interact with unpeace? I mean, what kind of connectivity really drives this unpeace that you're talking about?
So I have a very wide definition of connectivity, which essentially is about the globalization, as you say, of goods and services, the movement of people, the flow of ideas, of technology. And what I have come to understand is that it has brought out a lot of competitive instincts, both at the individual, you know, from the individual level through to our national politics, right up to the sort of planetary scale. And it's working in ways that are slightly different from what we expected when this period of hyperconnectivity began at the end of the Cold War. In 1989, you not only have the Berlin Wall falling down, which creates the opportunity for billions of people to be brought into sort of global economy who were excluded from it before, but also that happens exactly the time of the information revolution and the internet being founded and all sorts of new, much deeper, more densely networked world can emerge because of technological channels as well. What we found is that it does all of the good things that we hoped. It's created an enormous amount of wealth and convenience and has spread our empathetic horizons so we know what's going on right across the planet. But at the same time, within our societies, it's led to a huge amount of polarization. We know in all networks that people tend to seek out other people who are like them. And there has been a sort of self-segregation of our societies into like-minded groups who increasingly don't just share particular interests, but they share media and information. So it's not just that they have different views from each other. Living in our filter bubbles, we also have different facts and a different reality. And that fragmentation has had a profound impact on our politics, which is increasingly driven by identity and how people identify with themselves. And there are less and less links between these different groups as we go from having mass communications to much more customized, digitally driven communications. And those different groups also, and the people within them, are comparing themselves to each other in totally different ways. And I think that is driving an epidemic of envy. When we were young, Guntram, I think like me, you probably compared yourself maybe to your neighbors or to your parents or your grandparents. But the reality now is that we live in this sort of age of hyper comparison where everyone on the planet compares themselves not just to their neighbors and their parents, and their grandparents, but the most privileged people in the world. And sometimes it's not even real identities that they're comparing themselves with. It's sometimes fictionalized accounts of how great other people's lives are. And in those circumstances, you can only be disappointed by how your own life matches up to these extraordinary lives in other places. And I think that that's created a very widespread sense of envy, of grievance, of frustration with our own existence, which is almost sort of floating. There's so many people in different places who sort of feel that they're missing out. But it's not just at the level of individuals. I think one of the other things that comes from hyper-comparison is that we compare our governments much more than we used to. So if you look at COVID, you had daily charts in our newspapers showing who was up and who was down, how different people were doing. And I think that brings out a lot of competitive instincts between different players. A third way I think that productivity gives people a motive for conflict is that it often also leads to a loss of control. So the leitmotif of politics in lots of different places is about taking back control. And it's not a new phenomenon that people's lives are influenced by decision makers in distant locations. But in the first phase of globalization between the mid 19th century and 1914, you had a kind of two-tier world where you had some people who lived in the periphery in colonies, and they found that important decisions about their life were being taken for reasons that they couldn't understand at all, which had nothing really to do with indigenous conditions, had much more to do with the needs of the metropoles, down to the names of countries. You know, places like Argentina or the Côte d'Ivoire were named because of the commodities that were being extracted by the colonial centers. And the periphery lived in a state of kind of confusion, of lack of agency, a lack of control. What's interesting about the 21st century is that now the people who thought that they were the masters of the universe, the imperial centers in the UK and in the US, are the ones who feel the most out of control. And a lot of them, a lot of citizens who voted for Trump, who voted for Brexit, felt that they are now becoming strangers in their own countries, that important decisions are being taken by people who are kind of far from them. So I think that's the first way that it gives people a kind of sense of grievance and a sense of what their identity is. And I think that's fueling a backlash against interdependence and against kind of internationalism.
But Mark, to push you a little bit, what you explained now is mostly about communication and benchmarking and how you compare yourself, especially the globalists, so to speak, how they compare themselves to other globalists around the world. Yet there is another trend of thought that says, well, basically, this disenchantment with globalization is that it has not delivered actual results for the bottom 50%. So in terms of inequality, actual measurable inequality, wages and salaries in the US of the bottom 60-70% have not increased in the last 30 or 40 years. These are very objective economic facts. And then there has been, let's say, a small elite, at least in the US, a small elite of, say, 10% or so, that has managed to benefit from globalization, whose real salaries have increased dramatically, and who, of course, themselves do not feel locally attached anymore, but really do what you described. I mean, basically benchmark themselves globally with other business people, et cetera, around the globe. I mean, I see the communication point that you put out there, but isn't this fragmentation also very much a fragmentation of access to resources, access to opportunities within our physically still present societies?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. What you've described is something that we were quite slow to realize, though, because for most of the last 30 years, we've had this account which looked at the aggregate figures, which showed that the world has got a lot richer, that most of our countries have become richer as a result of globalization. And what they've hidden is the differential in terms of the distribution of that wealth, which has largely accrued to small minorities. And many people feel that they've literally been left behind. And that's kind of fueled this backlash in globalization. But in a way, that's just the first part of my argument, which is the fact that many people feel that they are suffering and that they're doing kind of less well, and that politics in many places is driven by a sense of identity and people fragmenting into kind of identity tribes that are resentful, that want to take back control, and often sort of pushing back against globalization and against interdependence. And then that feeds into the sort of second feature of what's happening at the moment, which is that these competitive instincts that have been around for as long as human beings have often translated into wars between different countries. But in the nuclear age, wars are impossibly expensive. I mean, the human toll of a great power war between China and the US is unfathomable at the moment. But even after a few decades where people thought you could do small wars, people don't really feel that comfortable about taking on the costs of another war in Afghanistan or in Iraq. But yet those competitive instincts have not disappeared. And what they're finding is a new form of expression, which is an opportunity which arises out of interdependence. And I think that if you look at a lot of the ways that countries are conflicting at the moment, it's not so much through great power war or even through normal war. More people commit suicide than die in wars every year now. Only 70,000 people a year are dying from armed conflict, which is a ridiculously low figure. But at the same time, people are using other means to compete with each other, which were not there when you had blocs like in the Cold War, which had very little contact with each other. And right, essentially, what you're seeing is countries manipulating the ties that bind them together. The metaphor I use is a loveless marriage where a couple can't stand each other's company but can't get divorced. What happens when the marriage goes wrong is the things which brought them together in the good times that become the tools that they use to hurt each other in the bad times. So in the marriage, it's about who gets custody of the pet dog, the holiday home, the kids. But in geopolitics, it's all of the forces that were meant to bind us together are now being kind of instrumentalized as ways of pushing back against each other. So you mentioned a lot of them at the beginning. It's about trade, which used to be about creating a division of labor and cheaper and more effective ways of producing products. Now, trade is as much about sanctions and tariffs as it is about bringing people together. Finance, migration. We saw how President Lukashenko turned refugees into bullets, which were armed at Poland and Lithuania as a way of pushing back against them. The internet, which has become a great platform for cyber attacks, for information warfare, for interfering in other countries' elections. All of these different great forces, infrastructure, you know, if you think about the debates around 5G, all these things which are meant to be bringing us together have now become tools which people are using to hurt each other. And that is the sort of third argument which I wanted to make, that you have this kind of new arsenal of weapons which emerges for all of these different things. And it means that we're in a world now where you don't have war in a conventional sense, but it's hardly a golden age of peace either, because there's a lot of violence, and there might only be 70,000 people being killed in armed conflicts every year, but there are hundreds of millions of people who are being hurt by sanctions, by cyber warfare, by weaponized migration, by all of these different things which are depriving people of their livelihoods, of their homes, and actually creating total chaos. And I argue that we need to therefore think differently about our security. And in the cyber realm, they've come up with this new word to describe the liminal condition that we have, which is somehow suspended between war and peace, which is called unpeace. And I think that it's not just a cyber issue now. It's about migration. It's about trade. It's about all these other issues. That's why I kind of call the book The Age of Unpeace.
Fascinating. Now turning to the solutions, I guess, let me start with a provocative question. Is China doing the right thing by basically cutting ties on the communication side, segregating the internet, controlling their own information space relative to the one of the rest of the world, but also increasingly on the trade side? China has the strategy of a dual circulation strategy in which it wants to sort of increasingly rely on its own domestic market so as to be less vulnerable to external relations. I mean, is that a way of reducing unpeace and increasing peace, or is your gut instinct still the opposite?
So when I first started writing the book, I kind of thought that the big divide of the 21st century was between open and closed worlds, and that the solution would lie in building a great new architecture for an open world and how to keep the world open. And when I started working on this, I realized that though I was right, I think I'm right, that a lot of the things which have made my life far more peaceful, more happy, more full of opportunity than my parents and my grandparents come from openness and from globalization and interdependence. There is a dark side to all of those phenomena, which many people are feeling in different places and which we've been blind to for a very long period of time. And that dark side is part and parcel of the same forces that give us the good things, and that actually it's impossible to design a model of globalization that gives you just the good features of connectivity without the bad ones. And if that's right, then the big challenge has to be about how do you manage interdependence to make it safer and less risky and less scary for different people. And that paradoxically, I think, does mean that you have to take some measures which might feel counterintuitive for people who are naturally internationalist. Because the place I don't want to go is where Trump and other people are trying to take us, which is a world of walls where we close down all of the things which have driven our society forward. So in order to avoid a world of walls, I think we do need to have a process of somehow trying to take the sting out of connectivity. My slogan is about disarming connectivity, because I kind of argued that during the Cold War, the most dangerous thing that we faced was the prospect of a nuclear holocaust. And therefore we had to have arms control as a way of dealing with that. For our own society is much more difficult, because everything can be a weapon. So you don't just have a few nuclear warheads that you can track down and put under surveillance. If everything can become a weapon, and most of these weapons are used in a way that's completely unregulated, that fall under the threshold of formal war, right, then so how do you start bringing them into a place where they're less dangerous? And I can argue, in a way, that's more of a job for therapists than it is for architects, because it's essentially about accepting who we are, working out how we can live with ourselves, and trying to detoxify it. So I kind of have this five-step therapy for our connected world. The first step is realizing there's a problem and kind of analyzing it. And you were doing that very successfully before. If you kind of realize that these aren't win-win things, that there are losers, you can then start thinking about what policy measures you can take in order to help the losers, to make it less risky so they don't want to build walls. The second step is very much about trying to build healthy barriers between different players. And I think that there are a lot of unhealthy things about what the Chinese are doing, what the Americans are doing, their protectionism. But it's not a coincidence that you have these three parallel debates about dual circulation in China, about building back better and foreign policy for the middle class in America, and about European strategic autonomy and sovereignty in our part of the world. These are symbols that people are quite scared about uncontrolled interdependence, and that they're realizing that not all ties are exactly the same. There are asymmetries in the system. And if your interdependence is not balanced, then you can open yourself up to be blackmailed and hurt and bullied by other players who don't have your interests at heart. And that does mean that you sort of need to think differently about how you organize your relationships. I hope that it means you can have healthy interdependence rather than autarky. For me, one very interesting example of that is the relationship with Russia around gas, where if you go back 15, 20 years, there are a lot of people who are worried about how the Russians were using gas as a weapon. And they said, we need to be independent of Russian gas and we need a gas NATO. And actually, luckily, a bunch of clever economists realized that the problem was not about interdependence with Russia. It was about asymmetric interdependence and the fact that we had lots of energy islands that were quite small, and that actually the countries that were buying the most Russian gas weren't really at risk of being blackmailed. Like Germany buys a huge amount of Russian gas, but it's a big consumer. It hurts Russia more than it does hurting Germany to cut Germany off. And Germany also has other options. It can choose and has a reasonably diversified gas market. The big problem was more a country like Estonia that was 115% dependent on Russia, because it both consumed all of its own energy was Russian gas, and then it exported some more, so that they were in a position where, and they had a tiny market, so it was cheap for the Russians to cut them off, and it was very painful for the Estonians. But by linking Estonia up with other,
the diversification,
exactly, and that, so that's one important thing, is that thinking a bit more about the structure of our relationships, so that they're sort of healthier, and making sure that you don't put yourself on the wrong side of very asymmetric relations, making sure that you have more options for yourself. Some of the other steps I had were being realistic about what you can control, but also self-care, which is a very important part of it. And I think that's another bit which you alluded to. If you have mass inequality in your country, that might be something which is accentuated by globalization, but there are countries that have managed to redistribute the benefits of connectivity much better than others. And that's called politics. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that some of the countries that have done the best out of globalization also have the biggest states, like in Scandinavia, for example. And what you're doing there is ensuring that the society maintains consent for globalization, because you're stopping people being left behind and you're helping the losers. And I think those are really important parts of making ourselves resilient. There's both things that we can think of in the international sphere, but a lot of it has got to do with how we organize ourselves.
Just a footnote, of course, on the Scandinavian point, it's not just the size of the state that matters, but the effectiveness of the state. The French state is also very large, but results in terms of inequality are far less convincing than in the Scandinavians.
Spoken by a true German.
True. So listen, I think your points are all very well taken. Managing connectivity, disarming connectivity, thinking about the structure of connectivity, the imbalances in the relations, diversification, and of course, self-care. I mean, these are all very convincing points. So if you were to look at where we are at the moment in Europe on these issues, what's the main missing point where you would say, okay, we have to step up? Where do we actually do very well? And I would say, if I can put forward that thesis, in terms of inequality, so the self-care part, we are doing actually rather well. Our inequality indicators look much better than those of the US, China, and even the UK for that matter. So I think on that front, one can of course improve, but I think a lot has been done. And on the sort of imbalances in the relationships with others, we are working on that, as you said already, under the heading of strategic autonomy. I guess there, I would love to hear your views on what's still missing, how much we have adapted, how much still has to be done. And of course, I would love to hear what you think in particular about the relation the EU is fostering with China and with the US. Is it in a good state at the moment? Is it imbalanced? Where does it have to go in the next years?
Thanks a lot. We talked a lot about how we're coping with these issues because Bruegel and ECFR have done some really wonderful work together on a lot of the aspects of European economic sovereignty. We've also looked at climate change, which is another really important domain where these things are playing out. You know, I do think that the European Union is a real response to a lot of these issues for many of our countries. And they, in fact, give us more choice and more options. But in a way, it calls for sort of Janus-faced policies, because there's questions about what we do between the whole of the European Union and the rest of the world and how we kind of handle ourselves in those relationships. In some areas, we're doing very well, as you're saying, and we have some real examples of us turning things around dramatically in a short period of time. I think the Russia energy relationship for me is a real success story, where we were in the wrong place 15 years ago for many countries. And we've disarmed that as an issue largely, not totally, but we're in a much better place than we were 15 years ago by taking clever policy measures and by using a lot of the tools that we get from being part of a European single market, which can do things together. But there are some big holes in it. I think the biggest hole was a kind of intellectual one, in that we basically thought we were still living in a win-win world. And we've had to face up to the geopolitical takeover of a lot of economic decisions. And we thought that decisions were being made for one set of reasons, but in fact, they were being made for other sets of reasons. And one of the challenges we have amongst Europeans is there's both a kind of ideology of liberalism and of economic openness, which was exploited by other powers that didn't necessarily share it. But also, our decision-making was much more siloed. You know, Bruegel has done a lot of work on the fragmentation of European power, and it's fragmented both between the nation states that have a lot of the resources and the EU that controls a lot of common spaces like the single market, but also between different silos. And we tend to think about the economy being governed by economic logic and security being governed by a logic of power. And the two are sometimes treated as totally different domains. And that's not how the Chinese or the Americans deal with these issues, which meant that we could find ourselves being blackmailed by other powers. I think that intellectual revolution has started to change, but there's still a kind of institutional challenge in a lot of areas. We have some enormous assets which could allow us to be real players in the world. The euro is the most obvious one, which is one of the big areas which the US has weaponized to allow itself to control a lot of its own affairs and to impose its preferences on other players. And Europeans are still caught in a dollar-based world. We benefit in many ways from that, because there are disadvantages, obviously, in having a global reserve currency. But we have lost a lot of power and a lot of agency, and we've been very reluctant to do the things that we need to do for the euro to be a real global currency, which could set its agenda. But I think that is something which is changing slowly, and we've kind of written about that together. But I think that there are kind of other areas where we need to put measures in place. I feel that the last 2 or 3 years been subject to a geopolitical awakening at the European level. The other challenge for us is the fact that the EU itself has been about sort of globalization writ small. And a lot of the things which have scared people have come about as a result of European integration, free movement of labor, supply chains, things like that, have put a lot of pressure on our societies. You know, I agree that we have much more effective states combating inequality than the Chinese and the Americans, though you're not setting the bar very high by comparing us to the Chinese and the Americans with their massive Gini coefficients. But we haven't always done that good a job at doing that. And it's very difficult because the starting economic conditions in, you know, Bulgaria compared to Luxembourg or Denmark are kind of vast. So you end up having these big, quite disruptive changes in our societies. Countries like Bulgaria and Romania have lost a fifth of their citizens to other parts of the EU, which have created big skills shortages, a lot of dislocation to their communities. And then the places that they go to have had different kinds of dislocations as a result of people showing up. And that was one of the big problems with Brexit, actually, that it wasn't managed. There was a big economic benefit to the UK from having mass migration from other parts of the EU, but there wasn't a political process to make sure that communities got extra resources to pay for teachers and hospitals and things like that, and to make sure the public services kept up with these flows of people. And I think that's also an area where the EU is trying to catch up with itself. The recovery plan is an example of us being aware that there are losers within the EU and that they need to be kind of helped out as well. But it's quite difficult, those dynamics within the EU, because we don't have a very legitimate political system, which you have within a nation state, that can redistribute large resources and that can legitimately really help out other players. And in fact, when we have redistributed resources or talked about it, that's often fueled a lot of Euroscepticism, as we saw during the Euro crisis.
Yes, indeed. Perhaps my last point, and we have to come to an end of our conversation, is really to push you a bit more on the issue of fragmentation of power in Europe, which you described some attempts to centralize decision-making power in the European institutions. But of course, ultimately, the real power still remains at the national level, while, of course, to be effective internationally, I guess one needs to have much more the centralization of power and instrument in one place. Now, at the same time, as you described, the European Union itself has been perceived from many member states, from the citizens in many member states, as a project of globalization, which increases interconnectivity and leads to dislocations within our societies. So what's your vision really on where the EU should go from here? I mean, and you mentioned already the recovery fund. I think the other big thing that happened in the last 1 or 2 years that I think is still underappreciated politically has been the decision to do the purchase of vaccines jointly. I mean, this has been a huge step. If you think about the most fundamental of all crises, a public health crisis where your own citizens' life is at stake, it is at that moment that member states decided to centralize the purchase of vaccine and centralize the distribution of that vaccine within the European Union. So a huge step forward in terms of centralization of competence. But of course, again, based on a European Council decision, moving that to Brussels and with perhaps not enough parliamentary oversight. So I guess I would love to hear from you. How do you see this evolve, and how will Europe become a more effective player, centralized power or not centralized power, become a more effective power?
I think that what we're seeing is a paradigm shift in how we think about the European project around this idea of sovereignty. So for the first few decades of European integration, the problem of sovereignty was seen as the fact that our European states had too much of it and that it was being exercised in an uncontrolled and dangerous way. And the whole idea of the European project at the beginning was about taming national sovereignty so that we didn't end up turning the continent into a graveyard for the third time in a century. And therefore, the early steps were very much about taming sovereignty. The coal and steel community is not a coincidence. So you start with the coal and steel used to make weapons to kill each other, and you socialize that. But the problem of sovereignty now is not about how do we tame it. It's more how do we get it? Because you have China and America making really important decisions. Exactly. If you look at the technological world, it's very much a bipolar world where you have Chinese platforms and American platforms, and there's almost no European activity in that space. It's less dramatic in other areas. But the worry is that between Washington, Beijing, Facebook, Huawei, Google, and Tencent and a few other companies, that Europeans are going to find that the key decisions, not just about the future of our economies, but even what our public space and our democracies look like, are taken outside of our control. And the EU, I think, can be a machine for reclaiming control if we start to think carefully in different ways. And ECFR, we conceptualized the new sovereignty problem around five different areas: health, the economy, security, digital, climate. And we've basically tried to think about how in each of those areas, the European Union and joint action can actually re-empower Europe's states rather than taking power away from them. And I think there you mentioned a very good example of health, where on the one hand, it is about centralizing power, but at the same time, what it's done is it meant that individual countries paid less for their vaccines and they got more of them eventually after a few teething problems at the beginning of that process. And, you know, in the economic realm, if we do want to be able to regulate Facebook and Google and these companies that are bigger than many European countries, the only way we can do it is with the single market. I think that we're finding on climate very similar things going on. We've written about the geopolitics of climate change. One of the most powerful tools that we might have is to have some sort of border adjustment mechanism for carbon pricing. And if we do that, we will have not just a huge impact on decisions made by European companies, but by Chinese companies and American companies and Russian companies. And that would be something that would be completely impossible for France or Germany, let alone smaller countries like Belgium or Luxembourg to do on their own. But I think it's a different way of thinking about it. On the one hand, you think about how do you reclaim sovereignty from outside, but at the same time, maybe have a slightly more sensitive policy space respecting set of institutions at a national level, where we maybe think more carefully about whether we need to have exactly the same standards in some areas where there could be differences between different member states of the EU, where those differences are not...
Subsidiarity in the best meaning of the word.
I think so. I think the philosophy's always been there, but the stakes are much higher now than they were before. And the sort of tools that we have need to be used differently. Competition policy, something else we've written about, which is a sort of classic example,
right,
where it goes from mainly being about stopping state aid and distortions because of the behavior of French or German or Italian companies to thinking about how do you deal with countries like China, which have got a very different model of political economy that are really distorting markets with massive subsidies and with asymmetries, which are beyond our control, but where we might be able to have some control if we redesign these tools that we have for the internal integration process.
Mark, it would have been wonderful to continue for another hour, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast, Mark Lennart, Director of ECFR. And if you have enjoyed listening to our podcast, please join us, share it on your social media feed, and join us on our website for more publications on these and many other topics. Thanks so much for listening, and thank you, Mark, again for joining us today. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.